other regions of her body, and headed out. That, Stevie thought, is confidence. Also, Ellie had bare feet. Stevie had the stupid flip-flops on. Her mother had convinced her that if she took them off for even a second, her feet would be attacked by terrible germs. The shower looked clean, but still. Also, the water wasn't kind of cold, it was completely cold. Still, a cold shower isn't the worst thing on a summer morning when you're already tired. This was pure mountain spring water. It was likely some kind of municipal water or something, but it was important to tell yourself a good story when you were standing under ice-cold water. Janelle was already at the farm table, intently reading something on her tablet as she ate a bowl of cereal. Pix was settled in the hammock chair, knitting. No one else seemed to be up. "Morning," Pix said. "Breakfast things are in the kitchen." Stevie shuffled into the kitchen and lunged for the coffee. She had a poke around the small kitchen, examining the contents of the cereal dispensers and the refrigerator. Suddenly, a bowl materialized next to her, causing her to jump.
"It's free," David said. "Pix doesn't count the cereal and send you a bill."
Stevie wasn't sure if this was supposed to be some kind of jab about money and lack thereof. Who said things like that? People like David, who also snuck up behind you in the morning when you were still half asleep. Did he know her family had little money? Did he want to play? Because she would play. No need to be nice, Stevie. Green light. She assessed him. He was wearing the same clothes he had been in the night before, and there were still one or two wayward feathers stuck in his hair. Either he hadn't slept or slept in his clothes. She inhaled gently, wine on his breath. Likely guess he was up drinking with Ellie. Interesting, but not enough. Look harder. In the daylight, she could get a better impression than she'd been able to in the dark of the yurt. His nose was long and fine. As he handed her the bowl, she took note of a band of wiry muscle that ran down his arm, and a beaten-up but expensive-looking watch on his wrist. The crystal face was scarred, but refused to break fully, and the leather strap, while worn, was still holding strong. She got a look at the face. Rolex. Now she was onto something. He had an unusual pattern of tan and burn on his arms. His one arm was bright red, the other just tan. Likewise, the one side of his face was much more red than the other. It was the kind of lopsided burn you got if you were half-covered or turned the wrong way for too long. "So," she said, gripping the bowl tightly. She stuck it firmly under the Fruit Loops dispenser and poured herself a big bowl. "You're from California?"
"So I hear,"
he said, getting himself a mug. She looked at the uneven tan again, the strips of healed sunburn, the pale patches, and his voice. It didn't have that slow, relaxed California tone. "Recent?" she said.
"Recent what?"
There was just a little edge in his voice. "Good. You moved there recently?" she said, popping a few dry Fruit Loops in her mouth.
"What makes you say that?"
He was smiling, but it was strained, his voice a bit crisp. The move was recent, and the circumstances weren't pleasant. Rich boy, recent move, the topic made him a little frosty, and clearly he was acting out and needed attention. "Just something I picked up," she said.
"Do you pick things up a lot?"
he asked. The smile was full now, but thin. He leaned back against the refrigerator as the coffee machine hissed. He twisted the watch a bit on his wrist. Stevie watched this motion for a moment. David stopped, seemed to realize what she was looking at, and put that hand in his pocket. Something bad about that watch. "Could you move?" she said. "I need the milk. I might as well get my money's worth." He smiled even more broadly and stepped away from the fridge door.
"Of course," he said. "The girl detective needs her breakfast."
Stevie smiled right back as she poured the milk and replaced it. "Daddy issues needs his therapist," she said. He laughed out loud, a little cough of a laugh. She had found a mark. It was a wide and easy mark, but it had landed. That little exchange should have been enough. It would have been perfect had it simply ended there. But, of course, there was no escape. He lived here, too. He took a seat at the end of the table and stared down the length of it. Nate joined them, creeping into the room with tousled hair. He seemed a bit more robust this morning and actually said hello to everyone.
"So,"
David said, a little too loudly.
What's everybody got today?
Advisor meetings, Janelle said. What are they like? I have Dr. Hinkle.
Do you like hearing people tell stories about getting lost inside the Large Hadron Collider?
David asked. Always, Janelle said.
Then you'll be fine. Who do you have, Nate?
Dr. Quinn,
Nate said.
Oh.
David shook his head.
Bind your wounds, she can smell blood. What? And how about you, Stevie?
That thin smile was on her again. Dr. Scott, Stevie said.
Captain Enthusiasm,
David replied. Stevie caught Pix give a little grin as she knit.
He's bouncy. Are you going to solve mysteries together?
David, Pix said.
Only asking,
David replied.
What did you mean about the blood?
Nate pressed on.
Is she hard? Just remember there's no shame in crying,
David replied.
After, I mean. Like me after I lost my virginity.
David, Pix said again. Don't freak people out. Dr. Quinn is fine. You'll be fine, Nate. Stevie was hanging back on the virginity thing. Was that a joke? Had to be a joke. What did it mean? Was that one of those things where you said something really vulnerable to make yourself seem above it all? Had he said virginity louder than any of the other words in that sentence? Was he talking about her virginity? Oh. He was watching her now. He'd put it out there as a tripwire. She shoveled Fruit Loops in her mouth, but didn't savor them. The sugar scraped against her teeth.
Is she going to ask me a lot about my book?
Nate asked.
Like what?
David said.
Like the plot? Best dragon? Like, am I done? Am I working? Oh,
David said.
Yeah, probably that. What's your blood type anyway, just for reference? David!
David held up his hands.
Kidding, kidding. He knows I'm kidding. You know I'm kidding, right, Nate?
Nate did not look like he knew this. And Janelle, who had watched this silently, was now ready to step in. Come with me later on today, Stevie, Janelle said. I'm going over to check out the workshop. I need to see where they keep the welding supplies. Can't wait to get my hands on my new blowtorch. On the word blowtorch, Haze appeared, wet from a shower. His golden hair was stuck to his head. Unlike David, he was pristinely dressed in white shorts and a blue shirt. Even in this early morning state, he still looked unnaturally good. Except for his eyes. Those were completely bloodshot.
What time did you get up?
David said, looking him over.
4:20. Didn't sleep much last night,
Hayes said with a roguish smile.
No,
David said.
Will we all be invited to the wedding? Beth, too?
Hayes shrugged and dropped into a chair.
So,
David said,
you're famous or something now? Or something,
Hayes said with a smile.
Yeah, maybe. Zombie business is big business,
David said.
People love the undead.
That's my life, Stevie said. I work at the Monroeville Mall. No reply from Hayes. In Pittsburgh, Stevie said. The Monroeville Mall. Hayes cocked his head and smiled at Stevie, but it was a smile of, I have no idea what you are saying. There was a definite echo of how her parents sometimes looked at her, and it made her cheeks burn. Nate looked up from the milky depths of his cereal bowl, first to Hayes, then to Stevie. What made you want to write about zombies? Janelle asked in what seemed to be an attempt to keep some normal conversation going. Ellie stumbled into the room wearing a pair of ratty harem pants and a shirt that said, Art Harder. As a greeting, she sat down and casually put her bare foot on the table and examined it for a moment.
I don't know,
Hayes replied.
I went home to Florida last year, surfed for a few days, and it just came to me. Sometimes when you get away, get a chance to think, that's when you have an idea.
You never know where you're going to get ideas, Ellie said. In Paris, we'd all sit around, have some wine, let it come naturally.
I'm kind of talking to P.G. Ederton about a movie,
Hayes said.
P.G. Ederton?
Nate said.
Silver Moonlight Motel P.G. Ederton? We're just talking,
Hayes said with a gentle smile.
But yeah.
Even Ellie took notice of this. P.G. Ederton was the kind of director she would know. He made quirky, art-house kind of movies about manic pixie everyones, movies that were turned into thousands of GIFs, full of phrases everyone knew.
Well,
David said.
Good luck with that.
Again, his meaning was unclear. It didn't sound like a good wish.
You guys better get ready, Pix called from the steps up to her rooms. You have meetings to get to.
Real life at Ellingham was calling. 9. Stevie walked in the clear sunshine of the Vermont morning, along the snaking paths and under the canopy of trees, to the great house. She rang the bell by the massive front door. In Ellingham's day, the door would then have been answered by his butler, Montgomery. Montgomery came up a lot in books about the case. He was the head of the Ellingham staff, trained in England, had served royalty, and was stolen away from one of the finest houses in Newport to head up the Ellingham Great House. After the kidnappings, he remained in service but was broken, shaken, and died a few years after. No butler now. Just a gentle buzz to signal the door was open. She stepped into the cavernous space. Security Larry sat in the shadows at his desk right by the front door.
Dr. Scott, right?
He said. Stevie nodded.
Have a seat over there,
he said, pointing to some chairs by the massive fireplace. A few people were already there, including Jermaine Batt, who was doing something very intently on her phone.
When it's your time, go up the stairs and turn left along the corridor,
he said, pointing to the balcony directly over his head.
He's the very last room at the front of the building.
Iris Ellingham's old bedroom, Stevie said, looking up at the ceiling.
That's right,
Larry said, leaning back.
You're interested in the case? What's your favorite book on it?
Murder on the Mountain by Sanderson, Stevie said without hesitation.
His style is annoying, but I think he explores the case in the most depth.
That's a good one,
Larry said, nodding.
Did you read the Ellingham case files?
I think that jumps to a lot of conclusions, she said. He nodded at that.
The air in the great house was cool, and there was a faint smokiness to it, despite the fact that it was very unlikely that anyone had smoked in there since the 1930s. She knew so much about this building. This main hall was made of rosewood imported from India. The 8-foot-high fireplace was constructed of pink marble from the Carrara region of Italy, where Michelangelo's marble was from. The fittings were all Austrian crystal, hand-selected by one of the 6 architects who worked on the project. The stained glass in evidence everywhere was in the style of the Glasgow School, which meant something very fancy, Stevie wasn't sure what, including a sunroom with a roof made of interlocking flowers and hidden birds.
Stevie? Stevie Bell?
She looked up at the sound of her name. Call Me Charles was on the floor above, at the rail, looking down. He was wearing a Green Lantern t-shirt and chinos, his hair a floppy, schoolboyish mess.
Come on up,
Call Me Charles said. He met her at the top of the stairs and extended his hand for a shake. A woman came out of a nearby door. The first thing Stevie noticed was her height, which was accentuated by a pair of black heels with a buttery, subtle sheen. As she turned, Stevie got a glimpse of the red undersides. She wasn't a fashion expert, but she knew that heels like that were expensive, as was the finely cut pencil skirt and the large, complicated blouse sweater, mysteriously flowing and folding. Her long hair was delicately colored in an array of auburns and golds. The woman was working on her phone.
Morning, Jenny,
Charles called.
Hey,
she said, not looking up. She strutted on, never missing a beat of her typing. There was no missing the dismissive attitude. Stevie had never seen anything like it at her old school. Charles smiled and covered well.
That's Dr. Quinn,
Charles said.
She teaches a seminar in American history and culture to all the first years. Come on, let's go to my office.
The creaking wooden floors had carpet runners to muffle the noise. Each door on this level was made of heavy, dark wood, with sharply cut crystal knobs that looked like they would be painful to touch. The last door, Iris and Call Me Charles's, had a corkboard attached to the front. This was entirely covered in signs, small posters, and stickers. Question everything.
Stand back. I'm going to try science.
I reject your reality and substitute my own. The biggest sign was in the middle and looked homemade. It read,
Challenge me. This was truly everything her parents feared, and it thrilled her as much as it repelled her. Inside, the room had definitely been converted. The pale silver wallpaper was probably original, but now the room was crammed with bookcases, a few chairs, a desk, and a small sofa. There were books everywhere, filling the bookcases, stacked sideways on top of other books, piled on the floor, resting on the back of the sofa, stacked along the mantel. There were 6 different diplomas and certificates on the wall, all heavily framed. Harvard, Yale, Cambridge. There was a picture of a rowing team, a group photo from Cambridge, evidence everywhere of a long academic career of importance. Charles waved Stevie into a chair.
So, he said, I have to say, Stevie, yours was one of the most interesting applications I've ever read.
Stevie sucked in her breath. Interesting was one of those uncertain words.
You're very enthusiastic about the history of this place, and in crime and criminal procedure. You have an interest in working for the FBI?
Stevie nodded stiffly.
That's excellent! Let's see what we've got here for you.
He consulted his laptop, taking a moment to put on a pair of glasses.
So, based on your interests, this is what we came up with. You'll be taking anatomy and physiology, statistics and Spanish. That covers your core and aligns with your interests, all very useful. Then we have you assigned to a tutor for readings in criminal justice and American legal history. You have yoga 3 times a week for your physical education. Everyone takes Dr. Quinn's literature and history seminar. Usually students do a small project in the first year that leads into the major project in the second. Have you given any thought to this over the summer?
Stevie swallowed hard. She'd said it out loud the night before, but now, facing Charles, facing the actual reality of the situation, could she say it again? She pushed the words past the lump in her throat. My project is solving the case.
Solving it?
Charles said, cocking his head.
Doing a report on it?
No, she said. I mean, figuring out what happened. Charles removed his glasses, folded them, and leaned back in his chair.
That's a fairly tall order, he said. Define that for me.
I've read all the theories, she said, steadying herself in the chair. I've read all the transcripts.
There are a lot of those, I think.
The main interviews are about 8,000 pages, Stevie said. I think the answer is here. I think someone who was in the house that day was responsible.
Hang on a moment, Charles said.
He leaned back and considered her for a moment, pressing his fist against his chin. Each moment of his pause pulled Stevie down into her chair farther and farther.
I have an idea,
he said.
Follow me.
He grinned the grin of a presenter on some educational show with a cartoon dog, as if to say, Come with me if you want to learn. Stevie hopped up and followed him back down the hall, to the back set of stairs. They went up a floor to a door with a polite private sign on it and a digital access pad. Stevie liked rooms marked private with digital access pads. Stevie watched as Charles entered the access code on the pad. He made no effort to hide the number, which led Stevie to think he wanted her to see it. 1936, she asked.
Not very creative,
he replied with a smile.
But easy to remember.
The attic steps were narrow, plain, stained dark. Once they got to the top, everything opened up into a massive space that covered the footprint of the entire house. It was very dark. The windows were covered in light-blocking shades and curtains.
Obviously,
he said, tapping the digital buttons on a panel of lights.
The Ellinghams had a lot of stuff. The papers went to Yale, some to the Library of Congress. The really valuable things went to the Smithsonian, or the Met, or the Louvre, or various art museums around the world. What we have here are the remnants of their lives. The furnishings. The dishes, the clothes, the household items.
Flick, flick, flick. The space came to light. Everything was nooks and corners. Every direction, just racks of metal shelving that went from floor to ceiling. Archive boxes and books in one direction, trunks in another. Lamps, vases, extra pieces of furniture, bedsteads stacked by a window, chairs clustered together in a tight communion, ottomans, dressers pushed back to back. There were rolls of old wallpaper, globes, boxes of crystal doorknobs. Stevie felt like her brain had been replaced by a few dozen bees, bumping and swirling in her skull.
"This way,"
he said. She followed without a word. Charles led her to the far wall, to a large lump about 4 feet high and 6 feet wide, covered in a silver satin bedspread. He lifted the sheet carefully. It was the great house in miniature, a perfect replica in dollhouse form, right down to the flower boxes in the front, which were full of tiny flowers.
"Albert Ellingham had this made for Alice months after she disappeared," he said.
He reached over on the side and clicked a hidden button, then swung the dollhouse open on a hinge, like a giant book. There was the atrium, the giant staircase. Everything was perfect, the lamps and the tiny crystal doorknobs and the fireplaces. Even better, everything was arranged as it had been then.
"I read about this dollhouse," Stevie said. "I didn't know it was still here."
"You can go into the other rooms by opening the back and the side," Charles said. "It's beautiful, isn't it?"
Stevie moved closer and bent down to examine the little rooms. There was Alice's room, complete with teddy bears on the bed. Iris's dressing room had little silver hairbrushes and impossibly small cosmetics. The kitchen was full of china dishes the size of fingernails, and there was Albert Ellingham's office, with two desks, tiny telephones, pictures on the wall, a replica of the past.
"It's a masterpiece," Charles said. "It cost $10,000 in 1936 money. We would have sent it to a museum, but all of Alice's things have to remain in the house as part of the estate. Everything that's Alice's stays here."
Stevie helped him close the dollhouse and the sheet was replaced.
"So,"
he said,
"why do you think I showed you this?"
"Because it's awesome," Stevie said.
"It is, but that's not why."
A dollhouse. The house in miniature. The world made small.
"It's simple,"
Charles said, cutting right to the answer.
"A grieving man made a perfect toy for his daughter that she would never see. This is about real people, not figures from fiction. I know this crime is popular, that crime itself is popular. But crime has a human face. If you're going to study crime, you have to remember the people involved."
Stevie couldn't tell if this was a rebuke of some kind or just one of those one-to-grow-on lessons, but it was fair enough. At least he was taking her seriously.
"To that end," he said, "before you get caught up in trying to break the case open, I want you to get involved in a smaller project, something that restores a human face to this tragedy."
"What project?" Stevie asked.
"Oh, I don't do that. You do that. You come up with something."
"But is this a paper or..."
Charles shook his head.
"The rest is up to you. I've got to get to my next appointment. I'm excited to see what you're going to come up with."
As Stevie walked back downstairs, her head spun with all she had just seen. Jermaine Bat came out of Dr. Quinn's door and hurried down the stairs, moving past Stevie. Her expression suggested someone who had just seen a document detailing how they died. Nate was waiting below. He watched Jermaine go and then turned around to Stevie.
"Well,"
he said.
"It was good,"
Stevie said. "He showed me the attic and some stuff the family owned." Nate nodded and folded his arms over his chest, looking around, not really paying attention.
"Did you notice something strange about what Hayes said this morning?" Stevie asked.
Nate turned back.
"You mean about Hayes not knowing anything about the Monroeville Mall? The setting of Dawn of the Dead and a super famous zombie thing?" "Yeah."
Stevie was pleased at how quickly she and Nate seemed to link thoughts.
"What did you make of it?"
"I have no idea. The guy looks like he came out of a 3D printer."
"Nathaniel?"
came a voice from above. Dr. Quinn looked over the rail.
"You may come up."
"You'll be great," Stevie said, putting as positive a look on her face as she could.
"Yeah, don't do that,"
Nate said.
"Fine. It'll be horrible."
"Thanks,"
he said.
I guess I'll see you at lunch or something.
He settled his brown canvas backpack squarely on his shoulders and took the stairs like a man climbing up to the guillotine platform. Larry watched this from his desk and stopped Stevie as she exited.
Dr. Scott gave you a little tour?
He asked. Of the attic, Stevie said. Larry tipped his chair back and picked up a pen, holding it like a dart.
And what did you think of it?
I think it's the best place I've ever seen, she said. Larry's expression never changed. His face was as stony and unmoving as the mountain they stood on.
Good meeting otherwise?
He asked. I think there's a lot to do, Stevie said.
You'll be all right. They work you hard here, but no one ever died of it.
I guess if you do, you can just take the body out into the woods and bury it, Stevie said, smiling. Larry did not smile. His eyes crinkled just a bit at the corners in an expression Stevie could not read. This was maybe the kind of place where you didn't joke about the buried bodies. April 14, 1936, 10 a.m. Leonard Nair Holmes was accustomed to gaps in the calendar, days that simply went away. Once, in 1928, he misplaced all of June, and he had no solid proof that 1931 ever existed. People told him it did, they showed him newspapers and everything, but you can't believe everything you read. So when Leo woke in his darkened room in Ellingham House that Tuesday morning, he went about his business after his nice, refreshing sleep. It was time to find breakfast. He scuffed out of his room in slippers and a tattered and overly long maroon silk robe that dragged behind, gathering dust. This was something, considering that Leo was well over 6 feet tall. He'd had the dressing gown made for a giant, all loose sleeves and big pockets and long drag. He made it as far as the landing before being scooped up by Flora Robinson, who pulled him to his room.
"Even if I wanted to, darling," he said to her,
"I'm going to need a grapefruit, 4 eggs, and about 3 ounces of gin before."
She clapped a hand over his mouth and shut the door.
"What's gotten into you?"
he said, reaching his long-fingered hand into the dressing gown pocket to find his cigarette case.
"Leo, Iris and Alice have been kidnapped."
Leo slowly raised his peaked black eyebrows and pulled a cigarette from the silver and jade case. He tapped it a few times on the side before putting it to his mouth. He patted his pockets. Finding nothing, Leo went to his bedstead and fumbled around for a moment, turning on the light and wincing. He dug through the pile of books and detritus, finally producing a battered box of matches to light his cigarette.
"They were taken when they went out for their drive yesterday, and there's been a ransom call," Flora said, keeping her voice low. "Albert brought George Marsh back. They're feeding the staff a bull story about how she spent the night in Burlington with a friend, and they're trying to keep the cops out of it for now. I know they did a drop last night that didn't go well. The kidnappers took the money, but they didn't get Iris and Alice back. They asked for more money. Albert's getting it now."
Leo took a few long, lung-congesting draws to get his brain moving.
"Oh,"
he said.
"Oh? That's all you can say? They've been kidnapped!"
Leo pulled hard on the cigarette, producing a burn audible from across the room, stroked the beard he had developed while he was sleeping with a blue fingernailed hand. He examined the edges of nail varnish for a moment.
"Have you cleaned up?"
he said.
"I did what I could," she replied. "For her. I went to her room as soon as I realized something was happening."
"For all of us, Flora. A rising tide sinks all boats."
"We need to do something," Flora said.
"Such as? I don't know where she is. I barely know where I am."
"We have to think. Who would do this? Maybe we should tell them everything. Maybe we have to."
"Flora,"
Leo said slowly,
"I realize you have a conscience, and that's what's talking now. But how will that help? It won't help us, and it certainly won't help Iris or Alice."
"You don't know."
"Think, Flory. Think. Have you noticed where we are? We are in the remote home of Albert Ellingham, tycoon. Anyone who likes money could have taken Iris and Alice, and everyone likes money. And anyone could do it because we are up on the side of a mountain. Albert will pay them.
Flora sank back against the wall.
You, my dear, need something for your nerves, he said.
No, Flora snapped. I don't.
They were interrupted by a heavy rapping at the door. Leo motioned for Flora to open it.
Morning, Albert, Flora said. I was just getting Leo out of bed. Everything all right?
No,
Albert said, all pretense gone.
It's not. Nair, I need you to make a batch of your invisible ink. I don't have my equipment. We have a fully equipped science lab here. Of course,
Leo said.
Give me a few hours. No,
Albert said.
Immediately, this moment. Make as much as you can, as fast as you can. How long does it take?
An hour,
Nair said, looking at Flora uncertainly.
Maybe two, it depends on the quantity. Then you have an hour. You take whatever is necessary from anywhere, but you must be quick. Let me get dressed, and I'll get to it.
When Albert was gone, Flora pressed the door closed.
Ink?
Leo said.
Ransom money, Flora replied. He must be marking it. You get to it, and I'll see what else I can find out.
Once Flora was gone, Leo locked the door and went to his closet. Inside, on a small table, was a small setup of scales and beakers and burners. There were delicate blue bottles that contained not an insignificant amount of chemicals of all sorts. Leo had always loved chemistry as a child. He mixed his own paints, which was why they had such an unusually vivid hue. He also made makeup, which was how he got blue nails, and Iris and Flora got such remarkable eyeshadows and blushes. It was why his own cheeks often sparkled faintly of silver. This was not a paint set, or a makeup set. He didn't waste time. He put the bottles and beakers into his satchel, pulled a pair of trousers on over his nightclothes, and walked downstairs as if he didn't have a care in the world.
10. Stevie had great hopes for the boarding school dining hall. She knew better than to hope for floating candlesticks and ghosts, but long wooden tables didn't seem out of the question. Long tables were also featured in so many murder mysteries, when all the guests of the house were arranged, eyeing each other over their wine glasses, wondering who Lord Dudley was going to put into his will or who might have killed Ratchet with the golf club. What she actually got was something that looked a bit like the buffet area in the conference hotel she stayed in with her high school forensics club when they did a tournament in Hershey. Just a little more artisanal and maybe crossed with a bit of ski lodge. Or what she understood ski lodges to look like. She had never been to one. It had a high, peaked ceiling made of bright pine and stone walls, scattered with tables of varying shapes and sizes, round ones that could fit a large group, square ones for four, and quite a large number of small ones that could fit only one or two people. There were also some plaid sofas and beanbags along the wall farthest from the food, with a few low tables, clearly some kind of coffee shop area for people who were too far up a mountain to get to a Starbucks. The chalkboard menu really seemed to emphasize that everything was local and that everything had maple syrup in it. The barbecue beef was in maple syrup barbecue sauce. The mac and cheese was made with smoked maple cheese. There was maple tofu and maple syrup dressing for the salads.
Did you forget you were in Vermont for a second? Stevie said to Janelle as they took their trays. Look down. You are standing in maple syrup.
Yeah, Janelle replied, a bit dispiritedly as she took some tofu and vegetables. It's not my favorite. Nate stared down the sneeze guard at the maple-ized meats.
I'll drink the living blood of trees, he said. Hit me.
The drink areas had sparkling water on tap, fancy, and a cooler full of expensive natural sodas that were free to take, including one maple-lime-spruce-flavored one that Stevie examined out of intense curiosity. This was the kind of stuff she never saw and wouldn't have had the money to buy, and it was just sitting here. This, more than anything else, seemed to indicate what kind of place this was. Free fancy sodas full of maple.
She took one. She had to.
Since it was still warm and bright, there were tables set up outside.
Ellie had commandeered a picnic table and began waving at them to come over. Hayes sat across from her. Janelle and Stevie started for the open door, but Nate hesitated.
Eating outside is the worst, Nate said,
waving away a fly from his plate, which seemed to be full of nothing but various meats. Vitamin D, Stevie said. You need it.
You don't know that, he said. I want to eat my meat in my room with the lights off.
As a writer, are those really the words you want to use? Stevie asked.
Yes, he replied.
Let's just sit with the others for today, Janelle said. We'll sit inside next time. Nate sighed and went along. So how was it? Ellie asked as they sat down.
It was great, Janelle said.
They're giving me access to the workshop, and I'm getting space in the art barn to work on my Rube Goldberg machine for the Sendel Waxman competition. That's the high school version. There's even budget to get supplies. This place is amazing. Mine was okay, I guess, Stevie said. I'm supposed to come up with some project this week about putting a human face on crime. Nate was quiet. Well? Janelle said.
She hates me,
he said plainly. Come on, Janelle said, shaking her head. Stop it. You can't be like this on the first day.
Yeah, I'm not kidding.
She said she hated you, Janelle said.
She never looked at me. She said something about how it's so easy for anyone to be published now, and then read me a list of classes and told me to go.
That doesn't mean she hates you.
You had to be there,
Nate said. Stevie felt eyes on her back, eyes to the side. She glanced around as subtly as she could and realized that no one was looking at her. People were looking toward Hayes. He was like a weak center of gravity.
What the hell are you drinking?
Nate said, turning the soda bottle to look at the label. Natural soda, Stevie said. It was there. I decided to try it.
Why?
Because I want to know.
It's going to be bad,
Nate said.
What is there to know?
You don't know that. Oh, my God, Janelle drew a hand over her face. Seriously, Nate, you have to like something. You can't go around being miserable about everything. Nate indicated that Stevie should drink and folded his arms. Stevie took a long swig. As soon as the drink hit the back of her throat, it attacked her palate with a woody, biting, cleaning fluid-type sensation that shot up the inside of her nose. She lurched forward, clasping her hand to her mouth just in time to avoid spraying Nate with a maple-lime-spruce fountain. She coughed so loudly that people at the adjoining tables stared.
Yes, Nate said. I see.
Tell me more about your book, Stevie replied when she could speak again. Nate returned to studying his plate of meats. Janelle suddenly half stood and waved. Vi, she said. Come sit here. Vi was back, with her tinted glasses, wearing an overall short set, a red tank, and striped knee socks. Her hair was perhaps a little spikier than the day before. She slid in beside Janelle. Again, a tiny panic bubble glurped inside. What if Stevie was going to be completely friendless? What if Janelle didn't pair bond with her and Nate never talked and that was it? Maybe she had given up her life before and come up this mountain and no one would like her and she would have to go home an abject failure. That was anxiety talking. Janelle did like her. All she did was ask Vi to sit with them, and that was because she wanted to flirt with Vi. And Nate, he was there. He was just a tough nut to crack. Things righted themselves for a moment. Until David came out of the dining hall, his unruly hair sticking up at odd angles. He still hadn't changed out of the clothes from the night before. Stevie had that same quiver of recognition, like he was someone she knew well. But there was no way they could have met before.
Hello,
he said much too loudly as he sat down.
You love looking at me. I get it. You didn't drink that, did you?
He pointed at the bottle of soda in front of Stevie. I got it for you. Stevie said, pushing the bottle his way. Ellie smiled and stretched out on the bench, putting her bare feet in David's lap.
Bad news, Hayes, he said. Someone was watching you last night.
He passed his phone down the table.
Looks like we have our own personal TMZ,
David said.
Someone named Jermaine Bat?
As he spoke, Stevie felt a ripple in the air around them. People had been looking, and now there was an undercurrent of chatter.
Your girlfriend is going to be pissed, David observed.
Hayes looked at the screen but didn't seem disturbed by what he saw.
Oh well,
he said, passing it back to David.
Guess that's what happens when you're famous,
David said.
Eyes everywhere.
For no reason Stevie could determine, Ellie put her foot in David's face, and he bit it. She screamed with laughter. It just happened out of the blue, something that weird and familiar. Stevie felt her insides flex and twist a bit, and a flush of anxiety run through her system. Vi and Janelle exchanged looks. Nate stubbornly refused to look up. Hayes didn't feel like he was really part of the group at all, somehow. Stevie felt very alone, except for a bee that had decided to linger by her ear and buzz furiously. Stevie was all right with being alone, generally, but this felt like she was being severed from the group, bit by bit.
You can always come home.
When she got back to her room, Stevie sat on the floor for a bit, looking at her research board. What if this place wasn't different? What if it was, as Ellie said, all bunnies on a hillside? She had come here because it was supposed to be different. What had she expected? She drummed her fingers on the floor for a moment and stared at the faces of the Ellingham family. Then she pulled her computer out of her bag. She couldn't sit there entertaining these kinds of thoughts. If she could learn some more about the people around her, maybe that would help. First, David. What was his deal? His last name, she knew from the student registry, was Eastman. David Eastman was a fairly common name, so there was a lot to sort through, dozens and dozens of search results. She added Ellingham. She added California. She looked up and down through every social media platform. An hour passed, and her butt grew numb as she sat in the same scrunched position, her computer pressed between her chest and her knees. The more she looked, the less David seemed to exist. No profiles anywhere. "Where the hell are you?" she mumbled to herself. There was a knock on her door and a gentle push. Janelle appeared in the space. "Hey," she said. "Can I come in?"
"Sure."
Stevie slapped the computer shut. Janelle fluttered in. She had a delicate way of walking on the balls of her feet, lifting the hem of her long sundress from the ground. Unlike Stevie, who was once again in black shorts, there had been a 3-for-2 deal, and she got 3 pairs, all black. Janelle looked like a summer picnic. A faint scent of orangey perfume wafted from her as she moved. Her braided hair was coiled precisely on the top of her head. "I'm sorry," she said, coming and sitting on the floor opposite Stevie.
"For what?"
"I ignored you at lunch. I didn't mean to."
"It's okay," Stevie said.
"You were..."
"Yeah,"
Janelle said, unable to contain a smile. She tucked her long floral dress around her knees and pulled the material taut. "You know I broke up with my girlfriend in the spring.
You told me.
And I didn't think..." "But Vi? I don't know. I don't want to be that person who gets obsessed and ignores their friends." Stevie felt a warm sensation all over, and something in her released that she didn't know she'd been holding.
"You like her?"
"I like them," Janelle corrected her.
"Sorry."
"Well, they seem to like you, too." "I just have to take a breath," Janelle said, plucking a lip gloss from the side of her bra, blindly and perfectly applying a coat and tucking it back in place. "We just got here. Maybe this is some kind of... I don't know. Gotta keep my head in the game. I have a machine to make, and this schedule I got this morning is nuts. I love math, but this scares me. Differential equations in the morning, calc in the afternoon, physics in the middle."
"That's nothing for you," Stevie said.
"I like your board," Janelle said. "Everyone needs a conspiracy wall," Stevie said.
"No,"
Janelle said, pointing. "You came here to do this. I've heard you talk about this. You got me interested, and I don't care about this stuff. You and me, we have this. And no matter what, we're going to stick together this year. I'm going to make my machines, and you're going to solve a crime."
When Janelle left, Stevie eased down onto her back and looked up at the ceiling. She had Janelle. And yes, she would solve her case. But now she had another one. Who was David? There was something there. She could feel it under her skin. Stevie had no fears of the dead. The living, however, sometimes gave her the creeps. 11. The next morning, Stevie shuffled to the window, wiping sleep out of her eyes, and peeled back the edge of the curtain to look out on a green sky. Had she believed in omens, she might well have taken this as a bad sign for the first morning of classes. But Stevie did not believe in omens. A green sky was a meteorological oddity and maybe something for Instagram, not a sign. Stevie brought an umbrella. Her first class, anatomy, was in the unsubtly named Genius Hall. There were only 6 people in the class. It helped that Pix was the teacher. At least something felt familiar.
Welcome to Anatomy and Physiology, she said. We are going to talk about the human body without any skin, about the body of muscle and bone and organs. Over here, she walked over to the skeleton hanging at the side of the whiteboard and picked up its hand. Are the 206 bones of the human body fully articulated? One of the first questions I get about the skeleton is it real? Usually they're plastic. But this one is the real deal. It was a private donation to the Academy, and every year, someone attempts to steal it. It is alarmed. Don't steal the skeleton. His name is Mr. Nelson. Be nice to Mr. Nelson. He's here to teach you about what's inside of you, inside of all of us.
Mr. Nelson, the real skeleton, grimaced at them with his big, empty eyes.
The bones themselves have their own geography. Peaks and valleys where they associate with muscle and tissue. You are going to learn the relationship of these things, all of these systems. Skeletal to muscular, nervous and endocrine, digestive, reproductive, excretory, integumentary, cardiovascular, respiratory. Once you learn what these things are, you will learn how they work.
There was talk of quizzes and tests. There were a lot. Labs, twice a week, and dissections. Far too many for Stevie's comfort. Teacher Pix was a lot more hardcore than House Pix. As Stevie stepped onto the green, the rain began, and in a moment she was in a hailstorm with chunks the size of marbles crashing around her. She put up the umbrella, but the battering was too severe. She ran. She made it as far as the cupola on the bottom end of the green, where she found herself stranded for a few minutes. When the hail got to the point where it was unlikely to pound her to death, she made a sprint for Eunomia, where she was to meet Dr. Velman for her one-on-one on criminology and sociology. Dr. Velman looked to be about 70, and, after reading off the list of books he wanted Stevie to get, and finding she had read 2 of the major textbooks already, proceeded to spend half an hour talking about the art and craft of the hangman, and how the best of them knew how to tie a knot just at the right location so that the victim's neck was broken quickly instead of suffocating. The next half hour, he talked about the breeding of dachshunds. After class, Stevie lingered for a moment outside the building, the rain drilling down on her umbrella. Her next class was in 2 hours. Ellingham ran like a college. You went to your classes, and your time between them was yours to make of as you wanted. No moving along with the crush of a high school hallway. No study halls that stank of Doritos and the dishwasher steam from the cafeteria. This was like being an adult. So she stood there in the rain like an idiot. Everyone else seemed to have some idea. She wondered if she should go eat or sit in her room or maybe just stand there forever. She took a deep breath of the moist mountain air. She had time. Where did she most want to go? What felt right? She turned toward the library. When she entered, no one was there except Kyoko, who sat alone at her massive desk eating an apple.
Hey, she called to Stevie. Come in. You're new, right?
Yeah, Stevie said. My name is Stevie Bell, and there's something I'd like to see.
You want to see Dolores's book.
Kyoko said, balancing her apple on her desk and wiping her hands. Stevie had been about to ask if they had materials on the case, so the offer of Dottie's book stunned her into silence.
I get a file on all the new students, Kyoko said. It's the librarian's job to know what materials are needed. You're interested in the Ellingham case. Come on back.
She waved Stevie around the desk station to a deep brown wooden door with the words, Library Office, painted in gold. Beyond the door was a large but cozy room. Everything here was original. Wooden tables and desks, wooden cabinets. There were large tables with books that were in the process of being bound or covered.
So you know the book was returned to us in 1993, Kyoko said. We keep it out of circulation because of its historical significance. Here.
She pulled a pair of blue nitrile gloves from a box and indicated that Stevie should put them on, which Stevie was only too happy to do. There was nothing she really wanted more than the satisfying snap of the examination gloves. It was a small thing, but it made the investigation just a touch more legitimate.
Here we go,
Kyoko said, putting on her own pair of gloves and opening up a glass-fronted banker's shelf and removing a thick volume. She set it on one of the tables and waved Stevie to it. The book was well preserved from years in evidence and library storage. It had a pristine dust jacket with a picture of Sherlock Holmes in a deerstalker with a meerschaum drawn in red on a white background. The book made a faint crackling noise as Stevie opened it. The pages were faintly yellow and the type was very tight and dense. There was a slot for library cards that read Ellingham Academy Library, but there was no card inside. The book had been checked out, but never technically returned. Stevie turned the pages carefully, and as she got to the first story, A Study in Scarlet, she stopped. There was a jagged pencil mark on one of the first pages, roughly underlining one line. It was a very famous line, one of the most famous in all the stories. Sherlock said, I consider that a man's brain originally is like a little empty attic, and you have to stock it with such furniture as you choose.
Did Dottie do this? Stevie asked.
No idea. This particular book was checked out several times by students before her. Any one of them could have marked it up. But I noticed that as well. Stevie glanced through the book, but there was nothing else in it. It was simply a book of Sherlock Holmes stories. But it was the book. That was what mattered.
As it happens, we know a lot about Dolores's reading, Kyoko said. This may also interest you.
She opened one of the wooden filing cabinets and removed an expanded file.
The first Ellingham librarian, Diana Cloakes, was a remarkable person. One of the top research librarians at the New York Public Library. Albert Ellingham hired her to come work here. Everyone he hired was the best at what they did. She bought an incredible collection, and she took meticulous notes on everything.
Kyoko pulled a thick stack of typewritten sheets from the folder and paged through them, then carefully set a few piles down on one of the big book tables.
When Albert Ellingham set up the school, she said, it was the policy that any book a student wanted could be ordered, and we have all the records from that first year. This pile, she pointed at one of the stacks, shows all requests from the 1935-36 school year. Dolores alone put in requests for over 500 books. The school ordered 487 of them. The remaining 13 were at a library in a university in Turkey that refused to sell them. If it's one of Dolores's, it will have the letters D.E. after the title.
Stevie scanned down the list. Dolores had requested several works in Greek, a lot of novels Stevie had never heard of, some classics. There were all kinds of requests from other students, including a list of very intriguing titles.
Gun Malls Magazine, Stevie read. Vice Squad Detective, Dime Detective, All True Fact Detective Stories. Oh, those, Kyoko said. Yeah, I love those. All pulp magazines. Most libraries or librarians would never have ordered them, but Ellingham's policy was clear. Whatever they asked for.
I so wish we still had these, but I think the students took them and didn't give them back. Stevie felt like she would have gotten along with those students. 2 days at Ellingham Academy passed by in a series of flashes. First,
There was just the weight of everything. The readings, the thought, the writing, the expectation of knowledge. It was kind of an academic monster truck rally. Everything went so fast. Session to session, reading to reading. Meals developed more of a rhythm. The overall groupings started to make sense. Some sat by houses, some were gamers, some read. Some people took food away and never stayed. Jermaine Bat tended to sit apart from everyone, watchful, always on a device. Gretchen, with the astonishing head of red hair, frequently held court over a long table inside. Hayes moved away from the Minerva table to start sitting with Maris and a very assorted group of artsy-looking people. Vi was a regular feature at the Minerva table. Nate started to talk a bit more. Ellie came and went, as did David, but they didn't come and go together. They didn't seem to be a couple, more just two people who were really comfortable in their skin and not very conscious of what made other people uncomfortable. After lit class on Wednesday, Stevie was walking across the green when a larger pair of ratty sneaker-clad feet fell in step beside her. Actually, in step, deliberate and rhythmic. Stevie didn't need to look up, didn't want to. But her neck craned in that direction seemingly of its own accord, like a flower bending toward the sun, if the sun was an annoying person who lived upstairs. She managed to avoid conversation with David for the last few days. If he was at her table, he sat at the other end. In Minerva, he stuck to his room. But now he was here, smiling, his hair flopping and unruly, his navy blue t-shirt looking conspicuously worn. There were holes in his shorts large enough to lose a phone.
"Hey, murder girl,"
he said.
"How's the case going? Got any perps? An unsub? How are your perps and unsubs? Am I doing it right? Perp, unsub, suspect?"
Stevie clenched her jaw. You could trip her. You could kick her in the shin. She could handle those things. But no one was allowed to go after her mysteries. That cut right into her.
"You know," Stevie said, "in a murder mystery, you'd end up dead."
He smiled wider and nodded. His body was ropey, like the word from the truly devious letter. He was long and thin and was probably strong. He seemed to be made of knots.
"What do you want?" she said, speeding up.
"I'm just walking this way," David said. "We live in the same place. What's the problem?"
"No problem."
"Oh, good."
They passed the cluster of statue heads on the way to Minerva. It was a weird landmark on the way home. Stevie was getting used to the statues, but this head-only grouping was still off-putting. It seemed like they were in the middle of a conversation and had stopped talking as strangers walked by.
"So Ellie was telling me about your conversation from the other day," he said.
"What conversation?" Stevie said.
She'd had several conversations with Ellie, but none seemed worth recounting.
"About you,"
he said. Stevie had to think about this for a moment. Was he talking about the conversation from the tub room? The one where Ellie had asked about their love lives and she explained she didn't have one?
"She said your parents work for Edward King,"
he said. She exhaled. Right conversation, different topic.
"Yeah," she said, waving away a bee. "Some of us just get lucky, I guess."
"You a big fan, too?"
"What do you think?" she said.
"Who knows?" he said. "Does anyone really know anyone else? You love some law and order."
There was no lower insult than this, and having to say she didn't like Edward King was even worse. Edward King was famously disgusting. Rich, corrupt, vain. He was the root of a lot of the trouble in Stevie's life. In less than 30 seconds, David had made two successful digs in the softest parts of her psyche.
"I'm not a fan," she said in a low voice.
"Oh, I was going to say, it sounds like your parents."
"I don't know why they like him," she snapped. "I try to work that one out all the time. I kind of want to get away from it here, so..."
"Sure,"
he said, loping along.
"You can't control your parents. I mean, my mother is a beekeeper, and my father invented the smorgasbord."
They had reached the blue door of Minerva. He tapped his ID to the panel to admit them.
"We have time to get to know each other," he said. "So much time. See you around."
He turned and went back the way they had come.
He didn't even go inside. Stevie was left to wonder what the hell had just happened to her.
This would not be Stevie's only strange encounter that day. The next would come an hour or two later, in the form of Hayes Major leaning in her doorway as she was trying to read.
"Hey,"
he said.
"Can I talk to you?"
He was wearing a tight white t-shirt, a fresh one, possibly never worn before. Stevie didn't buy white t-shirts. Their shelf life was too short.
"Do you mind if I come in?"
he asked.
"Sure," she said.
He left the door wide open and came inside with his easy, comfortable way. She indicated that the floor was his if he wanted to stay. He didn't sit. He squatted. It didn't look even remotely comfortable. It just showed off the tone of his leg muscles and the outline of his patelli. Anatomy word, kneecaps. She was already using her knowledge.
"I had an idea,"
he said as he balanced on his little invisible stool.
"You mentioned the other day that you needed a project. So do I. I was thinking, what if we worked together on something?"
Dust motes danced in the air between Hayes and Stevie. In the bright late afternoon light, his hair had an actual glow, like it was spun of golden thread.